Hello, and welcome to episode 6 of Let Them Eat Cake. This episode, we will be talking to a member of the social media group Horn Anarchists about the current genocide happening in Tigray in the north of Ethiopia. The member we spoke to is originally from Tigray and has a wealth of insight into the conflict. This will be the first of two parts covering Tigray. Part 1 will discuss the build-up and is likely one of the most in-depth explanations around the genocide in Tigray. Part 2 will cover the actual physical genocide. And as always, we are 5th Gen, an information warfare cooperative that aims to shed light on things those in power want to be kept in the dark. We want to give a voice to the voiceless and give people the information they need to thrive in a world that tries so hard to starve you of it. I'm Jack, and my co-host is John, and we hope you enjoy the show.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
For now, I would just go with Horn Anarchists, and I'm also I also most of the time run the Horn Anarchist Twitter account. I grew up and went to school in Tigray, and I would say I spent my formative years there too.
So you're really, really close to the region then?
Yes, I have family there.
Okay. So as far as history goes, you want to start at where the empire actually goes down and kind of lead it into what my question would be is, do you think communism destroyed Ethiopia or improved it?
Oh man, this is a hard question. Well, I would say it destroyed it, but this is not to say the monarchy or the empire was good anyway. So I think communism destroyed Ethiopia.
Can you expand on that a little bit? Like what aspect, what actually did it? Like what cascade of effects resulted in the fall that you would attribute to communism?
I think the fervor for Marxist-Leninist ideas came in the 1960s. And I think it is because Ethiopian students had more access to education. There were a lot of students going abroad for schools. So it came kind of late to Ethiopia. But there was some connections also earlier. There is some sources saying that there were some connections to the Bolsheviks, but it didn't get hold in Ethiopia in the 1930s. But in the 1960s, there was a lot of problems going on, social contradictions, crisis, poverty, famine, and the students were reading a lot of Marxist-Leninist books and ideas that were interpreted. There were translated books. So there was some agitation. Besides that, even before that, even though it's not framed as a class struggle, there was also, even during the monarchy, there was a robust labor movement. So most of the labor leaders were also Marxist-Leninists. I think one of them was Marcos Hagos. He was killed by the Derg regime. So there was, it was a both a student movement and labor movement, but most of the labor movement leaders were also Marxist-Leninists. But the military junta or the Derg was planning its own thing. Within the military, they formed a certain group and they took advantage of the agitation, student public agitation regarding the famine that was happening in North Ethiopia, including Wollo and Tigray. So when they saw that, everyone was mad, and the military committee, the Derg, took it upon itself to get rid of the monarchy. And that's how it all started. So coming back to your question, the reason I say communism, well, I would say communism, quote unquote, so we're not talking about the original, like the common understanding from the theory to the practice and different ideologies, what communism is. But when I say communism, I'm specifically talking about Marxist-Leninist.
Yeah, historical communism.
Yes, historical communism.
Yeah.
So what happened is at that time, there were so many groups, Marxist-Leninist organizations. I think about five. They have different, some of them are geared toward this nation-based or nationalist-based organizing. Some of them wanted a more, coalition? Or they didn't identify, they organized as Ethiopia, some of them organized as Tigrayan, Oromo, and some of them were dominated by Oromo organizers, others were dominated by Tigrayan, but most of them were students. The strongest Marxist-Leninist groups were, I think, in the labor union. So that's how it started. Then, because I mentioned there was slogans, the student slogans were land to the tiller, and the monarchy was bad, and it needs to be replaced with a communist government and stuff like that.
Is it interesting? Because I was going to ask this question. Did you find that they were looking to be the boot, or were they looking to get rid of it? So that sort of answers my question. Do you think that there's any benefits that happen in Ethiopia from communism?
Such as what?
Just like in general,
education, economic, yeah, literacy sort of rates, birth rates, infant mortality.
Like, was there any sort of beneficial aspects of it? As a,
you know, like even Hitler got people to stop smoking.
Sure.
Oh man, so if you mention Hitler, then I understand the context of the question. Then, yes, there were some improvements. Like Hitler did some engineering. There was a lot of development in engineering and science. In Ethiopia, there was the education, the literacy rate was had improved. Education had improved, especially literacy. Other things, I think the idea of worshiping a monarchy, a one king, one country, one belief system, and one emperor, or something like that. Then this was also completely destroyed. The idea of that was not tenable any longer. So I guess in that area, there were some benefits.
What is the Red Terror?
Oh, the Red Terror is a campaign of mass murder by the communist regime, communist military regime, trying to eliminate any sort of opposition in Ethiopia. So cadres, intelligence operatives, even neighbor or something can snitch on you or just invent a crime, and they would just, the killers would just come and kill you outside, and they would just leave the bodies on the street so people can learn. And mothers, families were not allowed to cry. In some cases, they were asked to pay for the bullet or something like that. It was horrible. I think it is said that about 500,000 people were killed in the campaign or associated with the campaign, but it's probably higher. As I said, there were about five that I think I remember reading about. So there were about five Marxist-Leninist organizations. They were extremists in their ideas. So their version of Marxism-Leninism is the only way, right? In that case, when the Derg regime took power, there was a group called Mason. I think it's in local language. So it's all Ethiopian socialist organization or something like that. And there was another also called EPRP. It has traces, they still have traces of it. It was also another Marxist-Leninist organization. There were smaller ones. There were some others who were embedded in the labor movement. There was a huge debate about how to approach the Derg regime. So the EPRP said, oh, this is undemocratic regime, so we cannot work with it, we should fight it. And the Mason said, no, I think we should, the government, the regime is bad, but we have to go inside and improve it and stuff like that. There is some complicated, so all of them hated each other. So they wanted to eliminate each other, kill each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the best part. Like when Stalin died, they all started killing each other, and then the clown ended up getting power. That's like the, my favorite part about Soviet Union.
Exactly. I think people who know about how what unfolded in the Russian Love Revolution would find this, the case of Ethiopia unremarkable. It's very similar. So, if I'm not mistaken, I think the Maison, the PRP started killing Maison members, right? And they called it. They called it white terror. It is still disputed because they kind of accuse each other of who started who, but I think the main like the most plausible is the EPRP started killing government officials, and the Mason members who joined the regime. So that's how, and then the government declared red terror, and they started about this what do they call it? Counter-revolutionary. It is. They said, "Oh, we will eliminate all the counter-revolutionaries. We will take measures, and by take measures, it meant we are starting a mass murder campaign all over Ethiopia." So that's how they started. As I tried to mention earlier a little bit, they were killing people, students, teachers, workers, anyone. You don't have to be, nobody investigators. It's just a campaign of terror, actually. And it wasn't necessarily that because of their ideology. So then people started either go to exile or go join the armed struggles that were happening around Ethiopia also.
When did communism end up coming to a close?
Well, it's an armed struggle. There were several armed groups. I think the longest would have been the Eritrean. Eritrea was part of Ethiopia at that time. It has just joined, and although the Eritrea was annexed to Ethiopia, the monarchy had dissolved the confederation that was implemented after a lot of international diplomatic efforts. Then the monarchy knew that this wasn't good for its administration because the Eritreans had more privilege than, say, for example, Tigrayans, which borders Eritrea. So they dissolved it. Then this instigated or enhanced the independence movement. The independence movement in Eritrea existed even during the monarchy. So during that time, the independence movement in Eritrea was just a few people doing some guerrilla attacks. But after the monarchy dissolved the Eritrean Confederation, then a lot of people sympathetic with the Ethiopian empire formation got disgruntled, and the resentment within the Eritrean population got heated. So I'm saying this because the Eritrean independence movement is important for the overthrow of the Derg regime and then Eritrean independence. So that's there was other armed groups also. Yes. So the biggest one, the most threatening, well, the most organized were Eritreans at that time. But once the Derg regime came, the Tigrayans also, some Tigrayan students also who were organizing, who were student organizers in Addis Ababa University and other places in the labor movement also started, okay, this regime cannot be reformed, so we need a national struggle. And then they dropped out of school and then went to mountains of Tigray and stuff like that. For Eritreans after 30 years, for Tigrayans after 17 years, the Derg regime was overthrown. The TPLF was the leading armed group within Ethiopia to overthrow the regime. So it had a critical role in overthrowing the Derg established.
And who was it? Was it? I know somebody recently, like, you know, within the last like 30 years, I think, was actually tried for war crimes. Which regime was that?
That was a Derg regime. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Mengistu Haile Mariam was a chairman of the Derg committee and the president of something Socialist Ethiopia. So he was tried for genocide, and he was tried in absentia. Yeah. and so many others also. His group, his people were also tried, and some of them got Andum from Amhara and ZOLF. I'm talking about in terms of in the end, I think they gave them parole, stuff like that. I think no, others went to asylum, the foreign embassies in Addis Ababa.
Okay, and now let's just get into 1991 through 2018 and really set up before the conflict starts.
All right, so in 1991, there were a lot of groups, there were a lot of political parties, but the major ones are the TPLF from Tigray, the ANDM or ANDUM from Amhara, and ZOLF. I'm talking about in terms of support in their base, in their home base. So the OLF was popular in Oromia. The ANDM was were in power formed. The ANDM was in Amhara, is from Amhara, but at least they fought for Amhara region or the Amhara population. But the thing is, when this was formed, the TPLF also organized a group in Oromia called OPDO. So it helped create its own ally in Oromia. And I'm not sure when the Southern political party was organized, but there was also another, a fourth one for SEPDEM in South Ethiopia. And part of it is, this is actually a little bit more nuanced, because the administration, the administrative region, the before they were administrated during the regime and the monarchy, they were called Kıtlıhagar, which means province. I think that's the closest to English, province. But once the 1991, in 1993, because there was a transition government from 1991 to 1993, I think. At that time, they formed regions. So ethno-linguistic, geographic-based federation. Now, this is administrative, right? Political and administrative regions. But when the government is formed, but because the EPRDF was formed between... the PRDF was formed by OPDO, the TPLF, the ANDM, and the Southern Party, Southern Political Party. What happened is the party state was difficult to differentiate. So the in Tigray, for example, the TPLF and the government are the same. In Oromia, however, it's a little bit different. One is OPDO, which has allied with, which has formed the EPRDF regime, but the oldest political party or social movement, you can call it so many ways, was OLF. So now what happened is they tried for a while, they worked together to form the Ethiopian state, the new Ethiopian state. But the story is a little bit murky because nobody tells you what happened. It's in Ethiopia, the politics is a little bit secretive. But what happened is, yes, they overthrew the quote-unquote communist regime in Ethiopia in 1991. The main armed group that overthrew the regime was the TPLF within Ethiopia. And in Eritrea, there was the EPLF. But there were also some Eritrean contingents working with the, collaborating with the TPLF in Ethiopia. Well, the TPLF at this time, once passed Tigray, the TPLF rebels or the Tigray rebels formed a coalition party or a coalition armed group, for what it's worth, composed of a rebel group from Amhara called ANDUM, Amhara National Democratic Movement, And they also formed OPDO, Oromo People's Democratic Organization. That's the Oromo Party. And the TPLF would be the Tigray People's Liberation Front from Tigray. Now, the significance of this formation is in Tigray, the TPLF was the dominant group in terms of politics, in terms of organizing. one can actually say after a lot of purges, the TPLF was the only political party and armed group in Tigray. But in Oromia, the dominant group was OLF. But the TPLF helped form the OPDO and in Amhara region, for Amhara party or for Amhara rebel groups. There were so many transformations happened, too long to make a detail, but we assume that most of the core Amhara elites were within the government. Or what Ethiopian nationalists would say, Amharanized people. So in this case, the Ethiopian elites and Amhara elites were within the Derg regime. So once the Derg regime falls, the core Amhara elites were out of power. This is significant because when the ANDM was formed, this means that the Amhara people weren't represented by people who feel they are representatives of the people. This is not to say about Amhara. This has nothing to say with the Amhara population or what they like or if they have a choice. This has to do with elite competition.
Power
competition, yes, among the elites, right? So now the Ethiopia or Amhara elites were out of power. ANDM is also an Amhara group. The party is formed from their base is Amhara. But the thing is, they are not the strongest elites within Amhara population or within Amhara elites. They are not the strongest ones. The strongest ones either left the country or within the government. And this would be significant in later developments. Similarly, in Oromo, OPDO, the Oromo People's Democratic Movement, was formed from Derg POWs and other elites. But it wasn't the strongest elite group within Oromia. Now, you will see that within the 30 years, there was a lot of opposition comes from this formation. So from the point of view of dominant Amhara politics, the ANDM is a quote-unquote puppet of the TPLF. Similarly, in Oromia, although not as strongly, the OPDO is also painted as the puppet of the TPLF. So what this means is the three main groups, form the EPRDF, Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. Right, it's also an armed group, then which turned into political group, national political group. So, when this was happening, the Ethiopian Federation was also formed along ethno-linguistic geographic group, but mainly language-based federation,
mm-hmm.
but not strictly. Like for example. In southern Ethiopia, a lot of ethnic, what they call nations and nationalist groups were formed as a single region, as opposed to, like, for example, Oromia or Tigray or Amhara, right? But the problem, one of the problems in the system is there was no differentiation between the party and the state. Supposedly it's a democratic system, because any political party can form a party and then compete in the election and then win the government, like take over power. But the thing is, practically, it's almost impossible because the EPRDF is so powerful for one, and they are also authoritarian. So they would repress if they think they're going to lose power, they resort to authoritarianism, especially during. Especially during protests, the repression was high during protests. So in this case, as you can see, in Oromia, in Amhara, especially in Amhara base or Ethiopian, pan-Ethiopian Amhara base, they don't feel like they're represented in the government. So one of the discontents, I told you that there is a problem with legitimacy. As I said, the most powerful groups in Amhara are not in power. In Oromia, the most influential people are not in power. But because of the way the EPRDF regime was formed and the lack of separation between party and the state, there was no way the OLF was going to win elections. Besides that, actually, during the transition period, there was some competition, elite competition, where the EPRDF party pushed out the OLF. We don't know. I don't exactly know what happened. We just know that some people say, even within the EPRDF regime, some people say that it was a mistake. But OLF was driven out of Ethiopia, categorized as anti-peace or so many names, terrorist group, stuff like that. And so which means you cannot have OLF views in Oromia. Now, in Amhara, as I said, especially many activists say there is Amhara hegemony and these people just want to bring back the empire, Amhara dominated empire and stuff like that. But the most influential people in Amhara region, in Amhara politics, I shouldn't say Amhara region because we should say Amhara politics. When I mention the Amhara people, Tigray people or Oromo people, I'm talking about the politics. This should be clarified because we don't actually know what the people think, right? Mm-hmm. There is no...
The Ethiopia, the way they control information, you can't really blame people for their conditions in a lot of cases.
Yeah, exactly. I guess the reason I say this is in order to determine what the people think, they should have all the options. They can freely choose and ideas are equally entertained and stuff like that. That wasn't the case in Ethiopia because the dominant party has all the state machinery. It can propagandize and like incentivize the population and without the others having the chance or the motivation to do that. So when I say Amhara, Oromo, and Tigray, it has nothing to do with even, not just with the people, but also what is a legitimate politics, right? We only know what the elites are saying. So I'm talking about elite politics or popular politics, not the actual or grassroots thinking, all right? So now I said two problems. One is the EPRDF regime. There was a problem differentiating between party and the state, perhaps by design. I'm pretty sure it was by design. So the people, and I said that the most influential elites from the other regions in Oromia and Amhara were out of power due to different mechanisms, like usual power competition, power intrigue situation, right? Now, the EPRDF is formed equally among these groups, right? So the Amhara region is ruled by Amhara party. There is no TPLF in Amhara region. There is no TPLF.
So they have autonomy.
Autonomy, full autonomy, except through other mechanism, internally or some techniques, right? Oromo has full autonomy, but this is not genuine because what happens if Amhara region revolted, for example, right? There was almost no chance Amhara region would revolt against the federal government because one, the Amhara leaders, Amhara group leaders are very close with the TPLF, even friends, right? And loyalties and power issues, right? The same thing with the Oromia. So they were so close that the Ethiopian Federation was not tested genuinely. While this happens, another contention is most of the key political posts were held by Tigrayan politicians, security, foreign minister, militaries, intelligence, and stuff like that. Optics is visible to everyone, right? Tigray is a minority population. And why are Tigrayans all in power? It wasn't a major conflict issue, but it later would become so. But when this was happening, then the war broke out with Eritrea. So Eritrea the Russian regime would say, oh, this is not a war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. It is just one group or clique, certain words.
It's just the Tigrayans versus them.
Yes, it's just the TPLF, yes.
Mm-hmm. What was this? What time period are we talking
about? The war broke out in 1998. It went on for about 2 years. So 2 years. So this one would also play a crucial role in the in what's happening right now. Actually, it might also be actually the biggest situation in the current situation. Okay.
Is that because Eritrea has joined the federal forces?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
But that happened because of what I have been discussing so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So continue. Even though it looks like that right now, it wasn't the driving politics in Ethiopia. In 2005, the election had ethnic undertones. There was talk of ethnic attacks and stuff like that.
Do you think that they bring up the ethnic stuff more just because of how the political parties are organized?
That's interesting, actually. That's an interesting discussion because I suspect, well, I can guess that some of the political parties would use that kind of thing behind the scenes. But it wasn't, this ethnic-based politics wasn't a national discussion. The farthest the people who begrudge the multinational or whatever ethnic federalism right now say, this ethnic-based federalism is going to destroy the country. This is not a good system. We should do other mechanisms.
And that's historically accurate too. Because
yes.
Like throughout history, ethnic politics often leads to breakdown. Do ethnic groups break down into regions? Is that what the regions are based on? How are the regions separated?
They are language based. They're not. It's very hard to say it's ethnic based because it's language based. The borders are mixed, but I think it is better to say it is ethno-linguistic geographic region. So there is no concept of ethnicity in Ethiopia. They call them nations or nationalities.
They're basically states.
Yeah, they're states.
It actually had a very similar, like, it not politically as in how the government set up, but the idea of America, where it's like a federation of states that come together. It's a very similar concept like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. So now, actually, I'm glad you mentioned America. America is... In America, the states are divided by some logic in the past, right?
Yeah, some river, something here, land, yeah, whatever.
Exactly. But in Ethiopia, I don't want to oversimplify this, but if you compare and contrast the American system, America is divided by states. Ethiopia is also divided by states. But America has other characteristics to divide the states to mark the boundaries. In Ethiopia, it is based on language, mainly language, all right?
Okay.
Not strictly, but mainly language. So if America was Ethiopia, it would be like, for example, if California was a TPLF and California was a Tigray state, right? Mm-hmm. And Oromia would be, let's say, Washington state, and Amhara would be New York state, right? Now, when they form the party, they formed it by representing the party from California, from Washington, and then Washington State, and then New York State, right?
Right. So, like the policies and stuff would be tailored to the specific areas, like California Democratic policies, and not the same as Texas Democratic policies, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they are separate parties, right? They form after the separate parties form a central party.
The coalition. Where,
mm-hmm. It was a coalition. Now, the problem is, in both states and the federal government, there was no separation of the state and the party. So this would lead to kind of its own problems, as we know, authoritarianism, right, and stuff like that.
Just to summarize everything, the TPLF is part of a coalition of states divided by language, and they're the most powerful ruling party of the EPRDF.
They are the dominant group, yes.
Okay.
That's to sum up everything that we just talked about.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And so I have another question, is how autonomous are each of the regions?
I want to divide this into two. One is administrative autonomy, and the other one is political autonomy, right? So administrative autonomy, I would say, and a lot of people would disagree, but I won't say mine, my piece, as people will say, administratively, they were completely autonomous. Administratively, other than when situation is like a conflict arises or stuff like that, right? But politically, it is meaningless to talk about political autonomy because the APRDF rules by consensus. So what this means is the policy is formulated at the APRDF level, and they vote on and they discuss and stuff like that. Then it is passed down to the regional governments. Now, this is where actually the dominance doesn't make much sense because the policies discussed and they pass it, right? They agree, it is by consensus. And there is no TPLF policy. They have Marxist-Leninist influences, but so do ANDM, the APDO had also Marxist influences. Not so much with the APDO, but the ANDM had Marxist-Leninist influences. This would be important.
You can see it in the TPLF's logo. It's a very, very communist looking logo.
Exactly. So is the Amhara region logo also, or flag. There is the Maoist flags and stuff like that. So now, in that case, the TPLF's dominance would come in how the economy is run. In that case, yes, the TPLF was dominant because of a few people within TPLF, not the organization per se, but because of some of the elites within the TPLF had some kind of statist, nation-building, state-run enterprises, stuff like that. But it doesn't make sense to talk about political autonomy of the regions because of this formation. The policy is made by the APRDF. But the APRDF is dominated by the TPLF, really a couple of people, a couple of knowledgeable people, right? Or dominant people who read and stuff like that. So that doesn't make sense. Administratively, they were autonomous. Politically, it mm-hmm. doesn't make sense to talk about political autonomy. Yeah.
So Abby coming into power.
Yes. So Abby's coming to power is very interesting because what happened is, as I mentioned earlier, ethnic-based politics wasn't a contentious issue.
And he made it one?
Not him also. What the farthest the opposition groups in Ethiopia would go was some of the people who do not like the Ethiopian state currently were saying, oh, the ethnic-based federalism is bad. It is going to lead to violence and stuff like that. But this is not. This was marginal. Marginal. Well, at least because of the Oromo population and Oromo elites, this wasn't very, very convincing. Except the cosmopolitan politicians and elites. Now, after 2005, things have changed. Even during the 2005 elections. The political campaign was ethnic tinged, as some journalists would say, which means what this means is, oh, why are Tigrayans, even though minorities, leading the country, ruling the country and stuff like that. It was huge at that time in 2005. But because this did not have currency within Oromo population or Oromo politicians, the APRDF said it won, the opposition didn't accept it. But because of the Oromo population, Oromo politics, the APRDF retained its power. At least that's what it looked like. But after that, the APRDF went a little further than before into authoritarianism. They started this 5-to-1 organizing in neighborhoods, and they started, they took a lot of authoritarian measures, and then it increasingly became authoritarian, right? Then in 2009, there was some kind of discontent following the Arab Spring.
That's interesting. Arab Spring affected Ethiopia.
Well, yes, people were watching what was happening during the Arab Spring, and some people agitated. So when the agitation started, the APRF regime started to get paranoid and started arresting journalists and political figures and stuff like that.
Yeah, but press freedom isn't great in Ethiopia.
It wasn't great.
Eritrea is worse. And I think Eritrea has like the lowest in the world.
Yeah, they don't compare. Eritrea and Ethiopia do not compare at all. So in Ethiopia, there is press freedom by legally, right? So there is press freedom. You can say anything what you want. But if you are an organizer, or if they feel you are threatening power structure, or if they think you have influence, and they arrest you, eventually they arrest you, right?
Mm. So it's more on paper, it's legal, but in practice, it's not, right?
Yeah. So the thing is, they don't arrest you every time. They arrest you whenever they feel like it. So you don't know when you are going to arrest it. You don't know when they are going to harass you or scare, intimidate you. But in Ethiopia, what they do is first, I think they intimidate you, or they call you and stuff like that. Then they say, if you continue writing this, you will be get arrested. You are breaking the law, or you are endangering security, or even sometimes they call you, you are denigrating the state or leaders and stuff like that. Sometimes they know that they cannot make a case, so they just say that. They call you and intimidate you. But sometimes they also create new laws to target certain people, right?
Yeah.
They also try to increase printing press, stuff like that. So they have these mechanisms to repress. But if you just pick up news magazines, they are critical of the government. Actually, almost all private press are very critical of the government. So even if people are arrested, even if people are in prison for writing, for saying something, you'll still find criticism of the government. There is no lack of criticism against the government. It just means one day you will get arrested. You just don't know when, right? So
that's very interesting, because it's something that we see consistently, is even with the criticism and the persecution, people will still come out and talk about it.
Yeah,
that it's sort of,
yeah, well, the thing is with Ethiopia, is the difference is the access to the internet. That so a lot of places that where they'll have access, and that was huge in places where the Arab Spring was happening, not Yemen, but pretty much everywhere else. So I was looking at a study earlier, and it was just comparing organization online for protests versus organization versus the elites in Ethiopia. And it's like just this like huge bubble at one end and a huge bubble at the other end, because like there's no organization that's able to be done online except for the elites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and regarding the internet, you see that actually the internet is a good indication of what press freedom looked like during the APRDF regime. So there were a lot of websites that were blocked in Ethiopia. You cannot access them. Some of them are not that interesting, right? They are a little bit racist and stuff like that, but that's not all, right? There were other outlets who actually analyzed the regime, the policies and stuff like that. So, but if they put something that raises ethnic conflict, or they feel, they just shut it down. Actually, they don't even have to justify why they shut it down. So it was completely blocked. The internet was completely blocked, which is interesting, because you would find similar criticisms in Ethiopia. Government critics were arrested, but criticism never stopped. It was not, it never was, like the, I don't remember any, they shut down magazines also, but there were criticisms always, but they got shut down for different reasons. Repression, as a repression mechanism, but it didn't mean that there was no criticism or critical content. So after Abiy, should we go ahead to discussing what happened after Abiy came?
Yeah, let's get into that.
So after Abiy came, then there was huge euphoria. There is press freedom, and they repealed certain laws that were against press freedom. They also repealed the so most of the press repression was happening based on terrorism, anti-terrorism law.
These types of laws, anti-terrorism laws, get abused all the time. We see it a lot, specifically for protests. The most recent one would be Hong Kong. So this is something that is very familiar, is abusing these laws. I mean, America did it, but not for protests. They abused it in a different way.
Yeah. Actually, Melles Zeinawi, the longtime leader of Ethiopia, would say, well, our terrorism law is just exactly a copy of the Western terrorism law. Everyone works like that. So the whole point of the, imagine an anti-terrorism law being used to repress the press, right? Repress free speech. So it is, and the way they justified it is, well, this is not unique. It happens everywhere. We copied it word for word from Western government. That's what they say, right? So when Abiy came to power, he repealed the anti-terrorism law or modified it, and the press law and stuff like that. But the interesting part is it didn't last long. He actually created a more stringent press law and terrorism law. He reinstated it. He made it even stronger. It didn't last long. Also, they say that he was a reformist, but the reform agenda or the reform process was started when the TPLF was the dominant group, right? He only released a few prisoners after.
Well, I mean, the TPLF technically, didn't they willingly step down?
Yes, they had a long discussion, and they had to work with the State Department, American State Department, and they made an, yeah. But the U.S. Department was heavily involved, so they resolved.
Yeah, that was their guy.
Mm-hmm. So, and the reason is he's Oromo, he's neoliberal, he's pro-American. At least he says he's pro-American. He's corporatist by culture. He's corporatist, and they really loved him.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the big things that I see him doing. Is really what he did is he opened it up for business. He opened it. So Ethiopia, we haven't touched on this yet, but Ethiopia is technically, it depends on if we can consider Liberia, but it's technically the only country that wasn't a victim of colonialization. And now I feel like he's kind of being like baking up for that, where he's bringing in all these different colonialist, you know, not really comparable to colonialism, but it's like a modern day type thing going on where there's all these investors and money flooding into the country.
Yeah. And what was happening inside the country after Abiy came to power was worse than, in my opinion, worse than what was happening during the PRDF regime, even not counting the years the PRDF regime was in power. But and also I told you about the reformation and the release of political prisoners. The political prisoners were released during the previous prime minister under Haile Mariam de Salim, right? But he also, Abiy Ahmed also released more prisoners, especially lower level prisoners and some high profile prisoners. But most of the high profile prisoners were released, had been agreed upon just before Abiy Ahmed came to power. So the idea that Abiy Ahmed was a reformist and he was completely different, that he was doing it on his
own. It was more media hype?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it was a process that was started and agreed upon.
It's like the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Like Trump already agreed to that. And people think it was like all Joe Biden, but it was like already in the works.
However, one thing Abiy Ahmed did is he brought all the opposition group that were arrested, that were repressed in the previous regime into power or close to power.
It was prison breaks with a hidden agenda.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. Now, these guys, the people who are in prison, I'm not going to talk about their politics because it's irrelevant right now, but they had grudges. Like mortal enemies of the TPLF.
You know, war gets ugly.
Yeah. And then what happened is Abiy Ahmed brought these guys into his circles. Like Burhanu Naga was a rebel leader based in Eritrea. Andargay Chosge, his comrade, was a rebel leader. He was in prison, life sentence, I think. And he brought him as an advisor. And it is said Andargay Chosge is the one who made the connection between Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea and Abiy Ahmed. So his circles became the most ardent enemies of the TPLF. So the war was inevitable based on this, but the Americans were not looking at this or purposefully ignored it. So when we talk about the reform, one, there was no reform. There simply was not reform. There was, I don't know, for 2 months, then it was reversed back immediately. The anti-terrorism law became stringent, even including like you cannot criticize the government, for example. You cannot criticize the good name of the government or something like that. It's good to read it, actually. The press freedom was also made stringent and improved in some situations. But basically, there was no improvement in policy. But in terms of application, it is a little bit nuanced. First, all the opposition, government opposition, became now pro-government. Previously, government opposition outlets and groups became so pro-government, increasingly pro-government. And the reason for this is Abiy Ahmed was bringing all the previous oppositions into his circle, and he was escalating anti-TPLF propaganda and anti-Tigrayan and anti-TPLF propaganda. They loved it. They did not want to lose this opportunity. And then all the previous oppositionist media and personalities groups became completely subservient to the regime, to Abiy Ahmed's regime.
Yeah, so then all you hear in the West is just how great everything is.
Yeah. So now a reasonable person would ask, well, the government state media is pro-government. The previously oppositionist group is pro-government. Where is the robust press freedom in the reform, right? If you are nice to your supporters, that isn't really the press freedom. It wasn't tested. But the other thing is, it required a little bit of time to develop an opposition group. It happened so fast. It was difficult. The people who are now not in power did not have enough time to like create, because they were in power, they did not have the time and all the resistant tools to create all this.
The rug got pulled out from underneath them.
Exactly. So they didn't even realize how things were so profoundly changed to even think about opposition, right? So the reform that Abiy Ahmed did is that bring the opposition, the ones that were released, into his circles. Now, when this was happening, there was also purges, especially against Tigrayans, Iran, civilians, people in security and intelligence. And so the soft coup that happened within the PRDF regime with intervention or the help of the State Department was completely changed. It became a complete regime change, not only in terms of regime, but also in terms of a question of whether the Ethiopian state should be reformed and stuff like that. Now, TPLF, the final coffin was when TPLF decided not to join the Prosperity Party.
They saw what was going on, and that he was consolidating power underneath them to put himself at the top.
Prosperity exactly. Party. If that's not a red flag, I don't know what it
is. But the interesting part is Abiy Ahmed. A comrade in Addis said, I don't think Abiy Ahmed actually wanted the TPLF to join the Prosperity Party. He wanted them not to join it, and then he made a certain moves. Enemy. That
You need an enemy for your regime.
That's very interesting.
Helps you keep power.
Yeah.
The other thing, the key part is that that is not discussed much when Ethiopia is raised, is Eritrea. As I told you, since Abiy Ahmed brought the insurgents into power, then he escalated the hostility with the TPLF, right? and they were happy. So this is the thing that they like, right? They have grudge, they have resentment, and that made the insurgents who were based in Eritrea made it possible to help him connect with Isaias Afwerki. In one way, you can think of this, the TPLF was replaced by the PFDJ. That would be the ruling party of Eritrea. You can say that because the security, the intelligence all came to Ethiopia and they started killing, I would assume they started killing Tigrayan generals, Tigrayan intelligence officers, businessmen.
Purges, yeah.
Purges and stuff like that. So you can say that the number one enemy of the TPLF was in power after Abiy Ahmed came when the TPLF were driven away and it would be the PFDJ, right? Now you can imagine how serious this is, right? It's obvious that shit is going to go down, right? Now, when this was happening, imagine the Americans who know everything, who have eyes and ears everywhere watching it happen.
Yeah,
watching it unfold,
constantly going over there and shaking hands with them.
Yeah. So what they look, what the Americans are looking is that, oh, Abiy Ahmed said we will liberalize Ethiopia, right? Open for business, and he even talked about how his economic policy was homemade, right? Which is fascinating, because homegrown economic policy. So I don't know which one. I mix them up sometimes, but his homegrown economic policy was advertised on Twitter account of either World Bank or IMF. Imagine that, which means liberalization, right? It's just neoliberalism. So what the Americans were watching is, okay, Abiy Ahmed is liberalizing Ethiopia. We will look the other way and sometimes actually encourage or like do PR coverage for him. So as this was happening, they thought, okay, this is escalating, war is coming, and he did this pretext to postpone, the pandemic pretext to postpone the election, and there was a lot other charades. They were watching this, right? So I think so far that is what is happening as we discuss it. Now, the most important, the most significant escalation to the war that's happening is the rehabilitation of Isaias Afwerki.
Which is the leader of Eritrea?
Yes. So Isaias Afwerki outsmarted everyone. Abiy Ahmed,
he's actually considered one of the worst people in the world as far as like rulers go. Like he's in like the top three.
And he has a long time. He has a long time Machiavellist tools at his disposal. So he outsmarted the Americans. He outsmarted Abiy Ahmed.